Because it's doubt combined with suspicion. Suspicion that what you are being taught, what you are being invited to do or to take up is not really in your own best interests. You know, and that it may in fact harm you. And that it may be that the motives of the people that are offering these teachings are not wholesome. You know. And that skeptical doubt can really kind of bring your practice to an end for a time being. So last week I talked about what, you know, I might sometimes call dueling doubts, which is to say, when the mindfulness starts to become really strong and you're really able to look carefully at what's going on in the mind, then this teaching that the Buddha had about the self is not something that we are, but rather something the mind does, that we actually create self on a moment-to-moment basis. So as the mindfulness begins to get stronger and you reflect on that teaching, it can come to seem more and more as if this may be possible. And you start doubting the existence of a permanent and abiding self. And then the self, of course, is highly insulted by that. You know? And so what it does in response is to start to create doubt in the Dharma. And so then you can have this kind of tension going on, kind of like a tennis match. You know, mindfulness doubting the existence of the self and the self casting doubt on the truthfulness of the Dharma. And then when you feel completely jammed up and lost and dead in the water, you know, that can actually result in some despair. You're really feeling ungrounded, not knowing where you are or what's going on. Those three forms of doubt also apply to one's doubts with regard to a teacher. Do they really know what they're talking about? Are they telling the truth, right? Where are they coming from? You know, when some of us who've gone through various of the teacher training programs at Spirit Rock Meditation Center or Insight Meditation Society, one of the things, one of the kind of aspects or art forms that we were encouraged to reflect upon is this notion of what's called getting out of the way of the Dharma. You know, just to say you want to share the teachings, but you don't want to have so much of yourself wrapped up in what you're trying to teach that it gets in the way of people being able to really hear the Dharma and kind of make it their own. So after I'd been teaching the Dharma for about 7 years, I guess, I went on sabbatical from my teaching position at the University of Colorado, which you take one of those every 7 years, which coincided with my seventh year of teaching the Dharma. So I decided it was going to be useful for me to take a break from teaching the Dharma as well. And so I did. I went for 6 months without doing any Dharma teaching. And during that time, I went on a long retreat, a self-retreat at the Forest Refuge back in Barre, Massachusetts, near Insight Meditation Society. And I actually planned it this way, one of the resident teachers at the Forest Refuge was the person who has been my teaching mentor since I finished my own training program 19 years ago, Joseph Goldstein. And so as my time sitting there was coming to an end, I had an exit interview with Joseph. And I was talking to him about my reflections on my my Dharma teaching, you know, and how I told him I felt like I was kind of maybe starting to enjoy it a little too much, and I had begun to, you know, kind of question my own motives a little bit, and that I had resolved that I didn't really want to teach the Dharma anymore until I could do it from a place of not self. And Joseph reflected a moment. He said, "So, what you're telling me is that you don't plan to do any more Dharma teaching until you've reached the fourth stage of enlightenment." He said, if everybody had that attitude, there would not be very much Dharma getting taught. Right? It's like we're all on this path. and to set out that expectation, you know, of having to come from some higher perfect place before you can teach, is kind of starting to miss the point a little bit in terms of what the Buddha actually taught about this nature of self and not self. He did say, as we were finishing our training program in 2000, the teacher role can be enormously seductive. And he said, just don't believe your own press. in other words, don't let it go to your head, because there is going to be a lot projected onto you. You know, people wanting to have a perfect teacher or somebody who can do no wrong or whatnot. And so he said, that's worth keeping in mind. Sharon Salzberg, who is also offering us advice at the end of our training program, and another one of my own teachers and friends, when she was asked how we should go forth, you know, and basically keep an eye on ourselves and on each other, she said, never stop being a student. Always seek to find some teacher from whom you have something to learn. Okay. And that will help keep you in balance and it'll help keep you grounded. So it's a matter of reflecting on motives and intentions. Okay. So, noble doubt regarding teachers. First off, it's highly contextual. It depends a whole lot on the lineage tradition. Okay. In the Vajrayana Tibetan tradition and in the Zen tradition, okay, it's highly structured and highly formalized, and it's a very kind of ancient structure as well. There are titles and there are uniforms and there are levels of empowerment and there are recognitions granted from senior to junior members of a teaching sangha. Right? And so their kind of quality control is very highly structured, you know. And there are certain levels of attainment that one has to be recognized to have achieved before one can be empowered by a senior teacher to move into a certain realm of teaching, and gradations that you have to move through as well. With regard to Theravada Buddhism or Southern Buddhism here in the United States, in the West, in Europe, and elsewhere, it basically takes two forms. About 1.5 to 2% of the people in the United States self-identify as Buddhist, and about 3/4 of them are of Asian ethnic lineage. So here in the United States, where we have meditation centers, which are also cultural centers that have been set up by ethnic communities in various cities around the United States. You know, they are meeting places, community centers for the people who are of that lineage. And they also support the presence of monastics there. Usually it's monastics who've come from Asia. So we have two Thai Wats here in the greater Denver metro area, for instance, one in West Denver and one out in Parker. And both of them support a certain number of Asian monastics who either come here and reside for months at a time or at least come and visit and teach. And so they look not to lay people like me, but like to their own monastics to share the Dharma with them and to do chanting and to lead them in various rituals and to offer the teachings, to lead retreats, to counsel them on how their practice is going, that sort of thing. So that's one form in which this tradition has come to these shores. The other form that's taken is by Westerners who spent long periods of time in Asia, some of them practicing as monastics in robes. Okay. And then when their own teachers felt it was appropriate for them to do so, would come back to the United States and begin to teach the Dharma. Okay. And the Asian Southern Buddhist lineages from which a lot of our own background comes are from the Southeast Asian countries of Burma and Thailand, Cambodia to some extent, and Sri Lanka. So most of us who teach, you know, who teach within the Insight Meditation community of Colorado or here in Isanga or whatnot, we were trained by Westerners who were trained by those Asians. So Jack Cornfield, for instance, spent many years as a monastic in Asia. And he sat a lot in the monastery of a famous Thai forest meditation master named Ajahn Chah. He also sat for periods of time with another Thai master, Ajahn Buddhadasa, in southern Thailand, as have other teachers from our tradition, like Guy Armstrong, and several others that are on the teaching council at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center. We also have teachers who spent years with Burmese meditation masters. You know, so Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, spent many years off and on at the Insight Meditation Center in Rangoon, Burma. And it's where they got a lot of their teachings that they brought back. And then they taught us, and they trained us. So at both Insight Meditation Center Society in Barre, Massachusetts, and at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Northern California, I used to be chair of the board of directors of the organization that founded Spirit Rock. They helped bring it back into being and bring it into being starting in the mid-1980s. Both of those have a four-year teacher training program for those who wish to devote much of their lives to long retreat teaching. And teachers from both those centers also teach in something called the Community Dharma Leaders Training Program. And that's something that Terry Ray and David Chernikoff and I were part of the charter class of, and graduated, started in the late 90s, and we graduated from it in 2000. There's since have been successive waves of that program. It has trained people like our very own Don Morreale and Johan and let me see, who's the guy that does so much outdoor work?
Peter Williams.
So we are kind of a mini teacher's sangha that is all been trained by the same people in that particular program. The people in the four-year program mostly teach long retreats. Some of us also have gone on with the authorization of our mentors to teach longer retreats as well. And so each of us, during the course of our training and afterwards, has had a teaching mentor that we would look to when we felt we needed guidance or counsel in what we were doing. So, noble doubt of the teacher. Regardless of tradition, there are questions worth getting answers to as you decide who it is you'd like to sit with and listen to, and see if you can learn anything from. What's the lineage tradition of that teacher? I just finished talking a little bit about mine and that of, you know, some of the others of us who teach here. Who empowered them to teach? With whom do they consult or look to for advice and counsel regarding their own teaching? What financial interests may they have in the teaching role? And whether or not they reside within any framework or organization that ensures accountability for teacher conduct. Kind of important. And we'll get to why that's important here in a couple more minutes. So the answers to these questions will provide some kind of important background on the route and means by which the Dharma is being conveyed by that teacher. Okay. So if you run across somebody who's read a few books and figures they're ready to start teaching the Dharma now, you know, they may have the gift of gab or, you know, be somewhat charismatic, you might want to, you know, find some means of learning a little bit more about what their background is. You know, what is their own understanding? What's the depth of their own experience? What have their studies told them? What tradition are they teaching out of? Those are all kind of, you know, caveat emptor, you know, checking out who it is that you might want to sit with and see if you can learn the Dharma from. A little something about their background. If they're saying something at odds with your own understanding of the Dharma, it's worth further investigation into whether they're simply offering a differing perspective on the same subject or topic, you know, or maybe from a different tradition, or because they're simply ill-informed, which happens, you know. It's therefore useful to respectfully ask what is the basis for the views that they're sharing, you know, if they really don't comport with your understanding of the Dharma. So, another cause for doubt on the teacher is not walking the talk, right? And there's a classic teaching of the Buddha on this. It's called the Quarrel at Kasambi. When the Buddha first began to teach and had a relatively small sangha that moved around with him, you know, they'd go from place to place, and then gradually over time, he became... As it became more and more well known, and as the power of the Dharma really began to be felt in the society where he lived, and the number of his followers grew greater and greater, it started to become impractical, and these thousands of people would try to follow him around North India. And so what happened instead, especially later in his teaching, would be there would be these centers that would be established here and there around the country, usually next to or near some village, okay. And the monastics living in that community, okay, would practice the Dharma together. They would go on alms rounds to the nearby village, and then in return they would teach the Dharma to the people who were living in the village, and in various centers they would also do things like pull school. You know, teach little kids to become literate, offer medical care, and kind of social services, things like that. And so one such community was this the community of Kasambi. This community had two highly regarded, erudite, senior teachers, who were kind of the co-directors of the sangha. One of them was considered to be the expert in the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. The other was the expert in the Vinaya, or the code of conduct for monastics, how the teachings ought to be embodied on a day-to-day basis in their behavior. And so these are both, as it turns out, fairly proud people who, you know, had high feelings about their own accomplishments, each of whom had a following of people who really thought they were doing it the right way. And so there was this instance in which the person who was the master of the Dharma committed what somebody alleged was some kind of simple offense having to do with the code of conduct. Whether they wiped off the toilet seat or something like that, but not a real big deal, but something that was reported to the master of conduct as an offense. And so the master of conduct listened to it and said, well, yeah, I think that probably is. And so the master of the teaching said, well, you know, I did it inadvertently and unknowingly, you know, and so I don't think it was. And then they were off to the races. You know, the master of conduct tried to tell the master of teachings that he'd screwed up and he had to apologize for it. And the master of the teaching said there's nothing to apologize for. And it split the sangha right down the middle. So each side had its own devotees. And they thought their guy was right and the other guy was wrong. And they started saying unpleasant things around about one another. And it was really making things rough within the monastic sangha. So a couple of the sangha members went to the Buddha and said, we're pretty jammed up here. Can you please come and help make peace for us? And so the Buddha did come. And he spoke to them. And he, you know, listened to one side and he listened to the other. And then he gave them advice on how to reconcile instead of having to call out one and force them to, you know, to kind of confess to something they didn't think they'd done. And so then he left, and they tried this reconciliation thing. It didn't work, and they got into it again. And so they asked the Buddha to come back again, and he did. And then they still couldn't get it. And when he was there, he actually offered a teaching that is the opening stanzas in the Dhammapada. We become what we think, all that we are arise with our thoughts. Speak or act with unwholesome intention. You know, and trouble will follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen who draw. And he was talking to them. He was saying, don't get so hung up about how you think one side or the other may have messed with you. He said, what you all are suffering from is something I have taught over and over again as a major source of suffering, which is attachment to views. And you just really need to let go. Well, they got into it again. He came back one last time, gave the teaching. Well, he said, you know, you people are hopeless. There's really nothing more I can do here. You either get the hang of it or you don't. And he left. And they got into it again. And then the people in the community that had been supporting the Sangha all this time, they said, you know, these people, they're not living the teachings. The Buddha came and said, attachment to views is a terrible form of suffering. And it's the absolute antithesis of what I've been teaching. You need to live according to how I've taught if you want to be a Buddha Dharma Sangha, not only in accordance with your own views and your own convictions. And they couldn't quite get it. And so the members of the community said, these people don't know what they're doing. They are not adhering to the teachings that they profess to be expert in. They are not living the teachings in the way that the Buddha wanted them. We have nothing to learn from these people. And they stopped supporting the Sangha, and it collapsed. And so some of the members of the Sangha came back to the Buddha, and they, you know, reintegrated themselves into his Sangha because they knew that they had just, you know, blown it in a pretty big way. So it was the Sangha, it was the supportive community who realized that these teachers had strayed a long ways from what it was they were professing to teach in terms of how to bring suffering to an end. And so the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, self-collapsed from lack of support. So teachers not walking the talk, especially teachers engaging in misconduct, especially sexual misconduct. It turns out that the Dharma in America is no more immune to the problem than any other religious tradition, whether it be Catholic or Protestant or any other. And as it is with other religious institutions, the more hierarchical, the more patriarchal, and the more opaque the organizational structure, the greater the potential for misconduct to occur. Okay. So, and it varies by tradition. I got to tell you, when in the very early 1970s, when I was first exploring Buddha Dharma, whenever there'd be some high teacher come to town, and in Berkeley there were a lot of them. They were coming through all the time. A lot of them lived there, actually. And somebody that used to come through regularly was Choyin Trungpa Rinpoche, crazy wisdom master, you know. And this was in 1971. I remember my wife and I and some friends went to sit with Trungpa in the Pali Ballroom on the Berkeley campus. And we were sitting up pretty close, and I watched him. And he sat there. During the course of his talk, he put away a fifth of sake. Right down the old hatch, right? And so, and that was before I even knew about the code of conduct and the Theravada tradition. And so I figured, well, you know, I guess that's his practice, you know. Turns out Trungpa was really kind of something of an alcoholic. But he did not have a direct supervisor telling him how to be. He was kind of beginning to free, and he was a masterful teacher. And he wrote books that moved people's hearts. David Chernikoff was a member of his Boulder Sangha for quite a few years, actually, until finally he said, the crazy wisdom tradition is wonderful and exciting, and I think the Sangha has got the crazy part right, but not the wisdom. Trumpet did, but not so many people in the Sangha. And so at any rate, it was only later on I realized that there are indeed kind of different kind of guidelines for different traditions and teachers at different levels of mastery. Fast forward to the late 1980s, Choem Trungpa's regent, his Dharma heir in the Vajradhatu in Boulder, Ozel Tenzin, is bisexual and is promiscuous, and he knowingly transmitted AIDS to people in the Sangha. Couple of whom died, and he himself died when he was having unprotected sex. He was saying, "Don't worry, the purity of my accomplishments will protect us both." That's, you know, pretty heavy delusion looking back on it, and it really shook the faith of the people in the Sangha, and you know, in a terrible and hurtful way. In fact, a woman that I knew up there at the time had started the first 12-step program within that Sangha, you know, so it really began the process of healing itself. Richard Baker Roshi in San Francisco was the Dharma heir to Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center and the Tassajara Zen Center. Brilliant teacher, great administrator, really built the Zen Center into a large and financially stable institution. Also committed adultery with a married woman in the Sangha. And the board turned him out. They asked him, please step down. This is inappropriate. We in the Theravada thought we were feeling pretty smug. We thought we were free of this because we were not so hierarchical. We were not as opaque, and we felt that it was maybe a problem that would not afflict us and how wrong we were. There were a couple of teachers in the 1990s who began, in some cases on retreat, having inappropriate contact with female yogis, and who reported it to other teachers in the tradition. And as a result, both those people were immediately dismissed from teaching at either IMS or Spirit Rock, which is at that point just coming into being. What the teachers in both of those centers realized at the time was that there needed to be a strong teachers' council with a strong code of ethics, and that any teacher in that group or any teachers trained by those people should be expected to adhere to those precepts. You know, at a minimum, the five lay precepts of not taking life, of not taking that which is not given, of not engaging in sexual misconduct, of not telling untruths, and of staying clear-minded in teaching the Dharma. And that was an expectation, and if that couldn't be adhered to, then they didn't really deserve, certainly, to teach at each of those centers. And if it was apparent that they were behaving that way out in the field, then whoever their own teaching mentor was could reach out to them and say, you know, it's probably not good for you to be teaching right now until you get your life together, until you figure out the work that you need to be doing. There is also mechanisms put in for reporting inappropriate conduct, ways to report into the teachers' council so that there could be an investigation. Okay. So that was the structure under which those of us who went through the teacher training programs, the CDL program, Committee on Armament program, were trained in. It's the code of conduct that we adhere to, and it's the code of teacher conduct that we're responsible for maintaining. And we try to do our best, like here in Colorado, all the CDL graduates who are on the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado's Teacher Council, we do the same thing. We keep, you know, we're there for each other, And if something really off starts to happen, if somebody comes forward, they don't feel comfortable talking to the teacher directly, they can go to somebody else, and then an inquiry be made. It's a means by which we seek to protect each other as teachers from getting into trouble, and also correcting it whenever anything like that looks as if it's going to, you know, maybe about to happen. I've trained teachers, Sangha teachers here, okay? They have their own council right here in our Sangha, right? They keep an eye out for each other. They care for each other in just the same way. Which brings me to probably perhaps the most serious and the best known of the cases that we've had to deal with within our own tradition here shortly. It has to do with the rise and demise of the Against the Stream Sangha and its leader. My sources on this story include both a limited amount of personal contact, secondhand knowledge, and a considerable amount of research from sources that I trust, such as well-regarded edited Dharma publications like the Lion's Work. And my intention here is simply first to report the facts as best I've been able to ascertain them, rather than cast judgment one way or the other. And my second intention or purpose is to allow a safe space for these feelings to be held and acknowledged, if there are any here who have been part of Against the Stream Sanghas. And thirdly, it's to suggest ways that we or any other Sangha can ensure that we can always provide a place of safety and refuge going forward. So the leader of the Against the Stream Sangha that I'm referring to is a person named Noah Levine. And I had a personal connection with Noah without even knowing it in 1975, because his mother was pregnant with him when she was managing the first meditation retreat I ever sat in this tradition with Joseph and Jack and Sharon. And at the time, his mom was married to a fellow named Stephen Levine, who became a well-known and beloved Dharma teacher in his own right. They split up when Noah was still fairly young. Stephen remarried a woman named Andrea, and they for many years lived and taught down in New Mexico, and they specialized in working with people who were approaching the end of their lives, and did some really beautiful and powerful work there for many, many years. And Stephen wrote a book about that work called Who Dies? And so if you are interested in exploring how death and dying are held in this tradition, I highly, highly recommend that book to you. But he and Noah were somewhat estranged. And Noah got into a lot of trouble real early, you know. When I spoke with him about this about eight or 9 years ago, he was here in Denver and he spoke at our Sangha. We had a kind of a joint meeting of the Against the Stream Sanghas and sitting groups, and our sitting group, and Noah gave teachings. And I was speaking with him briefly about, you know, that very early connection. He said, yeah, she had really profound, lifelong substance dependency issues from which she never really recovered. And for any of us who may have had parents with substance abuse issues, you know, that can really have an impact on your life. And so he got into a lot of trouble starting early on, you know, heavy duty drugs and dealing and crime, and he was in the, you know, kind of getting into the punk scene, some violence in his life. And he was getting in and out of trouble a lot. And his dad would try to help him out. And then by the time he was in the slammer again, about age 17, Stephen said, you know, there's really no more I can do. You know, you're not going to change until you're ready to change, until you want to change more than you want to stay how you are. And so then he said, okay, I guess I better try my dad's hippie meditation, as he described it, and he did. He found the Dharma. He discovered his profound healing capacity, right? And it saved his life, literally. And he got deeper and deeper into Dharma study, And he wrote a book called Dharma Punks. It's kind of semi-biographical. It is biographical, but also talks about how this movement came into being. The Buddha once said, my teachings go against the culture of the time, certainly the state religion of the time. So, my teachings are against the grain. My teachings are against the stream. So that's where the against the stream name came from. And it was people, it was made up a lot, these sanghas were people with a background similar to his. You know, history of substance abuse, maybe history of being in trouble with the law, who were struggling to recover, but at the same time really couldn't get with kind of theistic 12-step models like of AA, for instance. And so he had this ability to pull together that background. Desire for recovery with the Dharma, and develop this network of against the stream sitting groups, sanghas, throughout the country, right? And Jack Kornfield invited him into his four-year Dharma teacher training program, Spirit Rock. He completed that. The Against the Stream Sangha network really took off, and I've met more than one person over the course of my years who said, if it weren't for Noah Levine, I probably wouldn't be alive today. You know, I've been invited to teach a couple of times against the stream, one of the Against the Stream sanghas here in Denver when it was up and running. And it was people there, for instance, one person who shared that with me. I love being there because it was such a different take. You know, one of the things that goes on there, for instance, is that instead of there being somebody like me sitting up there talking the whole time, or most of the time, it'd be more like a go-around. It would be more like a 12-step meeting. Mm-hmm. People would come in and they would report what their experience was over the past week, if there's anything particular to happen for them, whether they found the Dharma to be helpful, or whether they couldn't figure out how to make it work. So there was this mutual sharing of experience, of support, and of teaching each other the Dharma in a way that I thought was really quite beautiful. It's also, by and large, a younger generation of folks. So I could see that the Dharma was being made available to people who might not otherwise have a shot at it, ever be exposed to it. So I had a lot of regard for what was going on there. And ATS was growing. They were getting big grants. And they set up a parallel refuge recovery program, non-residential intensive recovery program, based on a kind of a secular presentation of the Dharma. Thousands of people were benefiting enormously from this work that was going on. And the Against the Stream National Organization had its own Teachers Council and its own code of ethics that was patterned on the one in Spirit Rock Teachers Council, and that they exercised. I have knowledge of a leader here locally once who got in some trouble around misconduct issues. It was reported back to that council, they investigated and they asked them to step down from teaching. So they had a self-corrective system that was at work. And starting early this last year, there were allegations of inappropriate sexual behavior and conduct levied against Noah. And they were slow in coming, and they were they began to appear here and there in social media, and it was a confused and troubled time for quite some time. And then eventually these stories started coming forth more and more, and it was beginning to roil the Sangha. Noah felt that he was actually being kind of defamed to a certain extent. So he came forth and said, I may well have engaged in conduct that was inadvertently in conduct that was unappreciated. He said, I've never had sexual relations with anyone in the Sangha. I haven't ever used my position as a teacher, my position of trust, to gain sexual favors. And some of the things I've done, I really regret and I'm sorry for. Others, I just didn't do. What's being said about me isn't true. And there was some pushback. He lawyered up, and the boards of directors and the teachers' council at ATS decided it was going to be important to hire an outside investigator who has expert in these matters to thoroughly investigate, to interview dozens and dozens of people to try to see if there was anything there. And her report was given to the teacher council and the board. They examined it, and she had found that there was credible evidence from several sources to indicate that he had indeed behaved inappropriately. And then it also came out that he had in fact had sexual relations with a member of the Sangha. And he explained that by saying, well, I didn't hit on her, she hit on me. And that turned out to be the coup de grace, just as happened with the Kasambians. Support for ATS just began to fall away. Half the board of directors resigned. And by last fall, ATS had closed down. The national organization no longer exists. Many of the Sanghas, the sitting groups around the country, some of them disbanded, some of them changed their names, some of them disbanded and regrouped. And it was a very big rock dropped in a very small pond. My wife just came back from a six-week retreat at Insight Meditation Society in Barrie. And after the retreat was over and they could talk, she had a long, long, heartfelt conversation with a man who had been a very active member of the ATS organization in Los Angeles. And he's still grieving. You know, he said, my faith was shaken to the core. You know, I felt personally obliterated by what happened. I felt lost. I felt I had no Sangha. I didn't know how could something I put so much faith in, you know, have wound up hurting me so much. And yet he was on a 3-month retreat. Okay. So, it's a heavy story. It's a tragic one. And yet there is healing going on. There are things to be learned from that. I think that we can all hold in our hearts. You know. One of the reasons that things got as far down the road as they did in ATS is that so many people loved and respected Noah so much that they were disinclined to call things out when they saw them happening. You know, they're also afraid for the organization itself. There were warning signals, but they didn't get acted on fast enough. So all of this is in service to addressing doubt in all of its forms to make it possible for us to continue to regard the Dharma as a place of refuge. Okay. So it's a heavy lesson that I think we can all learn from. I know some here have probably been personally touched by it. And I'd like to leave our remaining time for anybody here who has anything they would like to share, whether it's about that particular case or about one's relationships or trust in teachers going forward, because it's a really important topic. You know, I was disinclined to even bring it up here for a long time until a couple of women in this Sangha about a month ago, some of whom had sat with ATS and who had done retreats with Noah, said, you know, I'm hurting. I'm really hurting and I don't know where to put it and we don't talk about it here. And now we have. And we will going forward. So if anyone has anything at all they'd like to share, this is a good time to do so. Please.
Since the teachers have a great responsibility, members of the Sangha also, I kind of contemplate that we have a responsibility to always remember that we don't just have one teacher. That would be actually not following the Dharma. So we should all have more than one teacher.
Yeah.
And then teachers don't necessarily take a human form. They could take any number of forms. So we, in our practice, I have a mind that if we remember that our teachers, it can be anything, it can be an animal, it could be a bird, it could be be something that we observe in being alive in nature. And maybe that helps to balance how it's to avoid putting faith in the voice box.
Yeah.
The Dharma's coming out of. To my mind, that's great delusion to mistake the Dharma leader or talker with the Dharma.
Yeah. I mean, that, of course. Yeah. We're all just sharing what we know, things that we found useful. And the Buddha, in fact, one of the things that tends to differentiate the Theravada tradition from others is that there's more emphasis placed on the Buddha's teaching on the importance of finding the teacher within. You know, the Thai meditation master, you know, I'm probably as closely allied with Ajahn Chah's lineage as any other in terms of my own teachings, the Dharma talks I listen to, the readings that I do. Ajahn Chah said, you need for your practice to consist of learning to listen to the one who knows. And what he was referring to there is our own intuitive spiritual wisdom, our own spiritual intuition. He said that lies within us. You know? It's different than knowledge. It's different from reading a book or hearing a Dharma talk. Okay? It's something that's innate, that is waiting to be awakened. And so a lot of the maturation of Dharma practice is by learning first to hear that still small voice, that voice of wisdom that's in there, that has our best interests at heart, you know. And it's easy to mistake it, either not hear it at all or mistake it for something else. But learning to trust in one's own spiritual intuition, to learning to, and in fact, as the Buddha was dying, his followers were around him lamenting. And they said, well, what are we going to do without you as a teacher? And he said, basically said, be teachers to yourselves. And he said, be islands unto yourselves, basically, by which he meant that you have everything you need within you to follow this path. Having teachings and having teachers, having noble friends and noble conversations is immensely helpful to help you find your way. But ultimately, it's your own internal guidance that's going to help you achieve that which you seek. And that's a really important lesson to remember, as well as sitting with a variety of teachers and, you know, maybe different traditions. I started out in the Vajrayana, in the Tibetan tradition myself, and sat with several Tibetan teachers, and then found that just for the purposes of, you know, keeping myself from getting too garbled and confused, that I better stick with the tradition I knew best and feel more at home in. But by all means, see what's out there. Go and seek. It's like you might find that at different times, different kinds of foods nourish you more than others. Yeah. Same is true of the teachings. Sometimes you may want to go deep into some doctrine or something like that. Other times you might want to focus more on behavior, on how to live the Dharma on a day-to-day basis in your lives. Sometimes you may decide you want to just take a break from the whole thing. Sometimes you may decide you want to sit 3 hours a day. So there's this natural rhythm to it, right? But overall, what we're all seeking to do is to learn to listen to ourselves and to trust ourselves, as well as listening to and perhaps trusting those who we think really have our best interests at heart and really have something worth listening to. So never stop being a student. But never remember that you're also a teacher. Teacher to yourself. Thank you. Could we please sit again for just a minute? As we go forth, May we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May we learn to listen to and to know and to be the teacher within. Thanks for being here tonight. I'll see you next week.